Mr. Patrick Long. Once again, thanks for coming to hang out with me. It's good to have you here. You look like you're doing pretty good. I saw that there might have been a little mishap. I don't know what you're allowed to say about it or anything like that, but I'm glad you're here, man. I'm glad you're looking good and you didn't turn into a pancake.
Yeah, I think I'm struggling more from event stress than I am from going upside down in a vintage 911. But all good. Seat belts, Hans race gear did its job. Testing street cars on the racetrack is no joke. And it's one of those deals. I think it's actually made me think a lot about how I go driving on the road or on the track. And, you know, if anybody should know, it's me, but sometimes you have to learn the hard way. But it was street speeds and in a vintage car. So it definitely hits close to home for lots of different people. And the internet loves a graphic photo.
Oh yeah, they do. Absolutely. I was watching Top Gear episode, and they were this new Bugatti race car. I forget what it's called. It's something in French that I can't pronounce. I don't know what it is. But the journalist guy is in the car with this race car driver, and they're, you know, doing full runs. And the race car driver, he doesn't move. He's got his full harness on. He's probably got his Hans device, everything like that. That dude hits the brakes as hard as he can. I swear the journalist goes like this, and he jumps about 2 feet because his harnesses weren't tight. And you just imagine that all that stuff holding in your seat is really what kind of saves your life in one of those situations.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I talk a lot about clients that I work with on racetracks, and I say know your exits. You know, I'm somebody who's jumped into hundreds of different race cars. Know where your fire bottle button is. Know where your door handles are on both sides, because you might have to get out the passenger seat one day. It might be dark, and make sure your belts are tight, and you know what seat and what seat mounts you're sitting in. And there's a lot of internet warriors that say, "Oh, dude, I drive with roll cage, and that's the only way." And like, well, there's some data there. You should do some reading about head proximity with no helmet on to roll cages, and also what the laws and regulations are around roll cages in streetcars. So, no, it's one of those things where you never know. It might be just a shakedown, or it might be a warm up, or it might be a 40-mile-an-hour hit, and you end up on your lid. So, it's keep the rubber side down.
AC Solutions offers complete plug-and-play air conditioning conversion kits for your classic BMW, such as the E30, E28, and E24, and soon-to-be Porsche. Featuring OEM-quality components with period-correct finishes and materials, their products are designed as a drop-in upgrade to your old factory system, but with the performance of modern technology. Their products stem from hands-on design and development with a deep knowledge and passion for these vehicles. They're designed by enthusiasts for enthusiasts and come complete with a full warranty and quality instructions mirroring those of a factory manual. Check them all out at acsolutions.co. That's acsolutions.co.
Yeah, for sure. I was speaking of the fire suppression stuff. I remember I was shooting something for 000. And I got into this race car. It was like a 65 911. It was the parts car. It was one of the first. It's called the parts car. It's one of the first 911s ever to be sponsored by Porsche. They gave them parts. Like, it was a big deal. Porsche, like, hey, we'll give you all the parts for this car. And then they had like a little van or a little truck trailer thing. Super like the opposite of the way things are now, of course. But I remember sitting in this thing. He's like, hey, I need you. Why don't you hop in that thing and move it over here or whatever? I'm like, okay. So yeah, get in the car. And I'm looking around. I can't find the starter, but like, there's no key really. I couldn't find a way to start the car or whatever. And I see this big red button in my hand. Like, it's like my body started to reach out for this big red button, and my brain's like, "Don't touch that. That's the fire suppression system." But my hand like continued to go. I was able to stop myself, but like this big red button. That's the fire suppression system. Yeah, you got to know where that is.
It's the mole on the intern that Austin Powers just wants to touch. No, exactly. It's
what a disaster that would have been, man, if I would have hit that. Oh my God.
Yeah, no, that's another big factor in it. But certainly, you know, there is this mindset when you go out for a canyon drive that's like, oh well, I'm just with my friends and taking it easy, so a lap belt and a repop fiberglass seat is fine. These are old cars, but I'm certainly looking at it a little differently, and it's a great segue to talking about going out and enjoying ourselves in the canyons with our friends.
Yeah, for sure. You know, we do that a lot with Overcrest, and, you know, all the cars are old. You know, everybody's, I'm always like, oh, I hope everybody stays safe. I hope everybody just kind of keeps their head on. And I think the trouble comes not necessarily when you're driving alone, but I think there's this feeling, it's almost like this group mentality that when you get with other people that have all kinds of different skill sets, you know, driving. I'm imagining you in your Aubergine car in front of me, and I'm trying to keep up with you. Give me a break. I'm going to die, right? There's just no way. The breadth of experience. And I don't know what the breadth of experience is between rally goer compared to me and you, but it's all over the place. The cars are different. The capabilities are different. You could be following a guy that doesn't know what he's doing, and he's just getting lucky. So it's really important to drive within your skill set and be really careful, because it can be over in a snap. Did you have any crashes when you were racing? Like when you were like out on the track, anything ever happened that, you know, kind of rivaled that, you know, fabled experience from a few weeks ago?
Oh yeah. This was not a fast off. This was not a big impact by any measure of what I've experienced in my racing career. 30 years of racing, it's been many, many more scary moments. I think the big contacts where you go 90 degrees head on into a wall at 120 miles an hour, like I did at Austin, I think 2016 or so. Those ones are the ones that really hurt. And that's where that abrupt stop and everything inside of you keeps moving. Those ones really, yeah, you know, knock the wind out of you and make you sore. I wasn't sore the next day. And that's thankful to, again, not just doing Autobahn speeds in a streetcar, but really developing something within reason. I guess when it's multiple cars, back to your point of driving with other people, and you're in a 5-car pack at night at Sebring, and something up ahead goes wrong, and you just have a big wall of smoke and dust, and it's the end of the race, and you keep your foot down, and it's car to car. That's the really brutal stuff, because of course now there's two people involved or more in the situation, and I can't begin to explain or even fathom what it's like to be at Daytona in the 500, 3x3, 20 deep, or my math's off there, 10 deep, 3x3, and then it all goes wrong, because that car to car stuff is brutal. So no, it's a dangerous sport. I've been talking to a lot of people and thinking about this hard, and we all think about it, and it's the stuff you don't really like to talk about. But, you know, modern street cars, let's go away from vintage. Modern street cars are super, super fast these days. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I'm thinking about right now, and I posted about before my incident a couple of weeks ago, was a 3-point belt, no head and neck restraint system. That puts us back 40 years in track learnings and technology and exposure. And there's a lot of track days these years, and there's a lot of moments where people are taking really fast cars out onto street, onto tracks. And I've been thinking about what the high levels are there, but certainly talking to some people who have done crash testing, OEMs that have shared their data on streetcars on racetracks, and head and neck restraint is a big part of that. I think that stopping the head and traveling in different directions is a big concern, but also 3-point belts and street seats on a racetrack, it's something that has to be dealt with a little bit of extra precaution in how hard we're pushing the limits of these cars.
Yeah, it's scary how fast they are. You know, I'm used to driving old shitbox. My 911 is pretty fast, but it's nowhere near as fast as some of this new stuff. I drove a GT2 RS when they first came out, or the 992 or 991. I don't remember which it was. It's too many 99s. And I remember getting into it and just hitting the gas for the first time, and it was unbelievable. It scared the absolute shit out of me. I was going 130 miles an hour before I could even blink. And it's just, I don't know. I'm not a good enough driver. I'm just not. I don't know. Maybe nobody is on the street, right? Maybe nobody's a good enough driver to drive something like that on the street. I don't know.
Yeah, I think whether it's street or track, it's so much more about the user than it is the machine. For instance, I could be out on a 4-stroke 50cc dirt bike and wreck myself, or I could be on a 450 outdoor supercross bike and riding within my limits and leaving margin for error, leaving margin for the unknown, the B factor, some deer runs out in front of me. Having that margin to adjust and driving within your limits and within the conditions and within the limits of safety and law. That's, I think, the bigger focus than like, oh, dude, you know, this car will, you know, it's not really, I think it's really about the spacer, the spacer between the wheel and the seat, you know, and that's a good reminder for me. I was up in my Aubergine car yesterday with a good friend who's doing great in motorsport right now, a young talent. And, you know, we were just taking it easy. I do say that on the canyons and on the street, you kind of lose the essence of a drive if it's white knuckle performance, herd mentality, ripping through canyons. That's great to feel the limit, and we all want that sort of machissimo experience. But the reality is there is another aspect to this, which is paying justice to these cars and seeing the world and being with people. So it is hard in that moment to remind myself of it, and I don't want to sound like a school teacher here. We all want to have fun behind the wheel, and it's and we all are capable of that. But yeah, just leaving that extra 10% for, you know, the blind corner driveway is key.
Petrolbox is a monthly service made specifically for the automotive enthusiast. Each month, they carefully select items including tools, detailing supplies, apparel, garage gear, stickers, and publications to be sent right there to your doorstep. It's a curated selection of the latest and greatest gear in the industry, and there's actually two different levels of subscription to choose from. The Petrobox Basic costs less than $20 a month, while the Petrobox Premium gets you even more gear for $39.95 a month. Check them out at mypetrolbox.com, and be sure to use the code Overcrest at checkout to get $6 off your first month.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like the speech I give before the rallies. Just look around, man. Look where you are. Just exist. You don't need to. This isn't a race, you know?
Right.
So you don't really race professionally anymore. And you talk about some like going into that cloud of tire smoke at Daytona and the adrenaline rush that it is. And I feel, is it the potential of that happening that kind of makes what you do exciting? Because you're already driving on the edge, and is there a danger there? Is that kind of what makes that exciting? And how do you get any kicks now? Because I'm just imagining you now as being retired, driving around on a lawnmower, trying to mow an acre as fast as you possibly can. You know, like, how do you get like a rush? Like, where does it come from?
No, I still like lust for all the things that I fell in love with driving as a young kid, and every part of my career as a pro for 20 years with Porsche. I still lust for all of those aspects, but I've just been able to fortunately strip away the frontline pressure of tenths of a second. I liken racing at a professional level to walking a tightrope for speed. It's fun to try and walk a slack line or a tightrope or across a beam. But as soon as someone stands there with a stopwatch and asks you to run back and forward for 3 hours as fast as possible, and then the kid next to you is 20 years younger, fitter, braver, and then it's his turn, and then it's your turn, and it's his turn, and you do that for 24 hours, that's a different level of love. That's a different level of driving. And I think when you really break down the psychology of pro athletes and pro racing drivers, for that matter, there is a big fuel behind that. And it has to do with ego, in my opinion. It is that willingness to get out there and constantly remind yourself and the public and the other race teams that are looking to hire the next best driver that you are the best. You are the bravest. You are the most consistent. And look, guys, I can do this over and over and over. I mean, the amount of times I've been at Le Mans, I've already driven 10 hours in a 24-hour period. I still have 3 more hours to go in my driving stint. And at that point, it's you and the lap time, because everything else, you're out there by yourself. So you're just there to pound the lap times and to be tenths of a second perfect over and over and over. And like anything, you eat a cheese sandwich every day for lunch, it loses its flair. It loses its novelty. And really, it is another level of discipline to remain on the front lines of pro sports. And for me, I racing didn't owe me anything. I have Lufkin Colt and now Air Water that sort of give me that challenge and that burning desire to wake up before the alarm clock and work till midnight. So I'm fulfilled there. I get to sleep in my bed more often and see my young kids grow up. But ultimately, it became about schedule. I am now in control of my calendar and where I am and what I sign up for. And I'm still doing a lot of driving. I'm doing a lot of consulting for different people who are building cars or trying to make race cars go fast. I still race vintage cars, rallies, different experiences, and a lot of karting, motocross, things like that. So there's plenty of outlets for your original question of going fast and feeling that adrenaline when you get out of a rad session. This afternoon, I'm going indoor karting with Patrick Dempsey. He wants to be a little bit more tuned up and back into the race seat. And I always say to my guys, it's more simple than you think. It's training the brain, the subconscious on car control. It's pounding laps physically and mentally and being really consistent. And there's so many cost-effective ways to do that, including sim. People roll their eyes and scoff if they're not into technology, but sim racing these days gives me an outlet if the weather's bad and I want to get out there and race against other people and test and tune my car and try to keep my focus up for an hour and be even more perfect than in a real environment. I think mentally it's harder to be just right on it in sim racing. But yeah, karting.
What's your screen name? Do you have like a top secret nickname? I just beat Patrick Long. Is it?
No, I've had some funny ones during the pandemic. I was doing a lot of iRacing and I just went in, you know, iRacing hooked me up and got me set up with all the tracks and different things. So I just went in as my name and I'd be racing like a short track. I'm already using the accent there. I'd be racing. I'd be joining like an Xfinity race or whatever they call it these days, a race at Bristol. And, you know, you plug in, you sign up and boom. You know, you're in this race and you're on the grid next to 30 other guys and girls and they're all talking before the race and they're looking at the different names and they're like, is that Pat Long? Pat Long, dude, I seen you take out Logano at Sonoma in the Winston West race 5 years ago. Is that really you? You know, and I'm like, I don't even know how my freaking microphone works on my headset. And I just like get out there and race these guys. And of course, they school you. But it is back to that challenge of, whether you're building a project car in your garage or you're trying to get your nationwide car tuned up to go racing on Saturday night on a sim race, it's pretty fun.
And I want to talk about air and water in a minute, but I just had one more question that came up in my mind is you talk about ego and you have to like you're constantly fighting against that other guy when you're racing professionally and you're with a team. And I think about we had a discussion kind of on the podcast a couple of weeks ago about like the breadth of skill. Right. The breadth of skill between, you know, me and you and like you and Lewis Hamilton, like, and like how much and as just a layperson, we wonder, like, how much better is Max Verstappen than Patrick Long? Like where how everything you watch all the drivers on in a Formula One race, they obviously there's winners and losers, there's better drivers, but the times really aren't that much different. These guys are all so good. So incredibly good, but like how much better are they than a guy that's doing GT racing or IMSA racing or something like that? Or is it just a different type of bringing up and come up?
It's very subjective and I'm sure everybody has their take on it, but I would liken it to someone who has no experience going onto a racetrack is going to be somewhere 10 to 20 seconds off. Somebody who's given their heart and soul in sport and has a decent amount of natural ability and a lot of preparation and a lot of good training, they're going to be within 2 seconds of a certain driver. And then you have sort of your top 1%. In that top 1% of people that can make a living, a justified, calm and comfortable living racing cars, it's the 1% of the 1%. And then you break it down to the Max Verstappen versus Sergio Perez. Max is on another level. It's clear. Sergio Perez is no slouch. Sergio Perez would win against 99.999% of the drivers out there in any other given race. But the B factor or maybe the A factor in your question is the equipment. So not Mercedes versus Red Bull, but a Formula One car today is so incredibly fast and so incredibly physical that there's nobody walking the streets that has never been in a race car that could survive driving a Formula One car, let alone a Miata. And so I think that watching it on TV, you know, as does the World Cup for soccer, football, look like, hey, I can play soccer, I can pass the ball, and I can bend it like Beckham. These guys are on another level. I mean, I talked about Max last night and I said, look, you start with Max. He had a Formula One driver dad who was intense and super, super successful and talented, not just a nobody that you've never heard of. I mean, Jos Verstappen was a legit driver and still would be today. His mom was an upper echelon, top professional level carter. When I was living in Italy in the 90s, Sophie Coupin had just finished up her career in Super A. That was the pinnacle of world karting anywhere. So first of all, you have a kid who's been born with DNA of two people who are talented at sport and driving. And then the next 20 years was the very best Wimbledon level training for a tennis player that he had. But it always then comes down to the innate talent, and something like a Verstappen is superhuman, just like a Tom Brady. It's mental, it's physical, and it's just that intangible talent. And there's not many sportsmen at that level. Whether or not he will be a legend, whether or not he will be an Ayrton Senna or a Michael Schumacher, probably comes down to how he applies himself to his sport and how marketable he becomes and how hungry he stays. Because a guy like Schumacher, again, back to that ego, you know, staying hungry for that long is a tough thing because you have other things pulling against you. You're comfortable with your finances. You have a family. You've won world championships like Lewis. How do you stay hungry and how do you keep yourself fighting for that last 1% of the 1% of the 1%? And Lewis is doing it. He keeps himself at that physical level. Look at Fernando. He's incredible. I was racing against Fernando at 14 years old. I can't envision what the physicality is for him to still be at that level in Formula One. And I just think that people think it's way easier than it is.
He's probably got some ice baths going on. I guess.
Yeah. Their athleticism is, I would hold it against any top athlete. You know, it's really, really at a crazy level, let alone how much sponsorship, promotion, PR and marketing that racing drivers have to do compared to stick and ball. It's arguably a lot more.
CSF Cooling has always been at the forefront of quality products for a fair price. With a rich history stretching over 7 decades, they provide the best high performance and OEM plus cooling systems on the market today. CSF offers over 3,000 different cooling applications for the most popular makes and models on the road today. From classic copper brass radiators for Land Cruisers, Jeeps, and Datsuns, to vintage 80s Mercedes, BMW, and Audi and Porsche platforms, all the way up to new vehicles. Check out their expanding Classic Series lineup and be sure to check them out at csfrace.com or on social media.
The last question on this topic before we move on is, and this comes up between just regular dudes. I bet this doesn't come up between, maybe it does. You can tell me if I'm wrong, but I feel like race car drivers don't really talk about this necessarily. We're always spitballing of like, hey, what if you put Max Verstappen in Senna's car from 1991? Would he be able to do it? Right? Because you look at the cars and you know, we just had Andy Boulet, who's an engineer. He does aero stuff at a Formula One team. And he's just like, I look at the cars and the way that they drove and they dance and they seem so much more dynamic. And they're, you know, if you go even farther back, they're shifting the car. Right. And then there's this danger level where would you have had like do these guys have more confidence now knowing that if they hit something, they're probably going to live versus the guys back then where they thought I might not come home today. Right. These guys had to be thinking about that. Could you put these new guys that have been racing in this new stuff their whole life in an old car and have them still be as competitive versus bringing the old guys into these new cars that, you know, just switching spots? Who's going to be more successful?
That's a great question. I've never fielded that question or had that conversation. I'm just going to take an angle and go with it. If you took Max Verstappen today and put him on the grid in 1988 against that current lineup at the front of the field. I don't even know my Formula One history enough to tell you who the 88 guy to beat was, but he's going to do really well, but he's not going to be in the last 3/10 of whoever that was. Was it? I'm going to go with Nigel Mansell and Prost. You know, it wouldn't happen because it was a different sport. It was a different fundamental of how to go fast. There was a much wider margin for error with no traction control, H pattern shifting. You know, that part of it, you know, Max for sure knows how to drive a car and could rip that car more quicker than anybody else you'd pull off the street for sure. But the nuances of making those cars go fast and just the discipline and how different it was, he's not going to rival somebody cold turkey straight in. Would he figure it out? Absolutely. Because ultimately it's the talent. He just needs the experience, to tame that beast and to understand it. In the inverse, if you took, somebody from 88 and brought them at their shape and their physicality at the front, the top guys already were in a really, really good shape, and you put them into the modern car. I'm not an engineer. I don't have the G-force numbers in front of me, but I think that first of all, physically, it would be pretty gnarly for them, on the neck. The hands and shoulders and feet, they were probably stronger in 88 because that was a bumpier ride, no power steering, et cetera. Yeah. But the edge of taking a modern Formula One car to the last 3/10 that Max will put on anybody in qualifying, that is a crazy acute discipline that's super, super different. And again, taking somebody from 88 into 2024, another, it's a different sport, quote from me, it would take them probably even longer to find that edge. And that's the thing about modern technology in motorsport. The window of fast and average is so small because now everything is pushed to the absolute last degree and last 10th of a second. The cars can handle it. The engines can handle it. You've got, you know, overpowering science in all of the different technology, all the different knobs. I mean, that would be the first part of a driver from 88 getting strapped into a car today. It'd be like, how do I even get this thing out of the pits? What are the button are codes? Yeah. What is this? Yeah. How many different things do I need to plug in?
Drive so mode that's two.
Yeah, what? Exactly. Just, I mean,
just
I just
be
drove
drive mode flat out. What are you talking about?
I just drove the 963, the Penske LMDH car at Rennsport at the end of 2023. And during my test, Penske came over the radio and said, I need you to go to switch 4.6 and go to logger 5 and go to green zone. And I'm driving this car in the middle of the lap and I'm thinking to myself, yes, I studied the 800 page manual, but you're going to have to break this down for me in layman terms, or I might as well just pull the car in and you can make the change. But they saw something on the telemetry where, you know, a certain fan wasn't on and things were getting a little warm because I was probably less average than they expected to me as a washed up old racing driver. And I couldn't do it. You know, I just said, tell me, is it the fourth switch on the right? At the bottom of the steering wheel, or is it one of the gauges over to my right hand side that there's another 25 buttons? So the technology is wild. I'll bring it back to center and say that at the end of my career, my GT3R had two different levels of traction control. It had ABS. We had balance of performance, BOP. We had driver ratings. And ultimately, to drive the car on the edge, it was a very digital experience. I had lost the lust for driving, going back to a 996 20 years before, and H pattern, synchro box, big, powerful engine. It was more of a really good street car racing at the Rolex 24 at Daytona, and that's what I fell in love with. And now there is this very digital mentality, which means that the talent still shines through, but it's so much of a smaller window that the art form of driving had been lost, and it really became about engineering from behind the wheel.
How do we get that back, man? How do we get that art and that, you know, the nuance?
More power than you have tire and aero, you know, less driver aids, get rid of ABS, get rid of paddle shifting, and go back to IROC in the early mid 70s.
I love it. So we were talking earlier and you mentioned that you're putting together Airwater, and you have Lufkicult now. And I think it's cool that you're doing Airwater, mainly because I look at you as a, I know you love the air-cooled stuff, but you started just after the 993. So your love for for water-cooled stuff must have always been pulling at you the entire time this Lufkicult show is going on. Like, oh, man, I really wish I could have a this or that here. Oh, it'd be so cool to do. And you're finally doing it. Like, what kind of encouraged you to do the Airwater show? Like, what happened that caused that to drive forward?
Yeah, that's I'm long-winded, which is my namesake. I'll start by saying that water-cooled cars, both race and street, are such a big part of Porsche's current but also history. when you talk about a 996 being over 20 years old, it gets very interesting in how collectible 996, 997, 991 even, and how the modifications of those cars and the personalization and unique nature has really kind of grown up on Instagram and become part of the Porsche car culture. I do think about celebrating the race cars, but I think about water-cooled cars even before water-cooled 911s. Transaxle cars are an awesome vintage, sort of the stepchild of Porsche's vintage line, and there's so much great history.
It's been awesome watching those come up, man.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
they were hated for so, so long, and maybe it's just because 911 stuff and everything went so crazy that people were, like, forced to find something else to like, but I'm glad they did because they're truly good. They're good cars. They're fun to drive.
Yeah. And even to zoom out for a minute, air water is a different experience. This is not Lufke Colt with air and water cars. Right. The cars are the dressing. The cars are the clowns that show up to perform. But the ambiance and the theater of the event will be different. This was piloted at Mare Island last year on day two of Luft 9. Now it's its own separate standalone show. And this is a vision that the team at Lufke Colt has had for quite a while. And I've been discussing with Jeff Swart for many years. And, you know, there was a brain bubble in 2022. We did a Porsche-only parking lot, free to park, but Porsches only inside the parking lot at the Port of L.A. And I went out there in the middle of a little bit of a ticket disaster where our security team decided to throw two metal detectors into the load-in, but that's a separate subject. So I'm out on my bike looking at this line to get in, saying these are our early customers, and so I'm negotiating with security. And then out of the corner of my eye, I see a train of Porsches driving into the Porsche only lot. And I'm like, I have to check this out. I rode for 90 seconds videoing, and it was six deep for 90 seconds driving down a road. There was 1,000 Porsches in the parking lot at Luft 8. And I said, this idea has to be acted upon because we are in a culture where these cars want to play, and we need to highlight transaxle. We need to highlight overland. We need to highlight a 997 Flying Lizard RSR and tell these stories. There's too much quality out there. But at the same time, Luft needs to be concentrated, and it needs to be curated, and it needs to be an art show, and it needs to remain connected to its roots. So I'm going to let air water breathe itself into something different than Luft and not dilute Luft and change what we love about Luft. So air water will have exhibitors, which we don't really have at Luft. We have sponsors and partners, but now I want to feed an aspect of the community and bring people into a covered space and let them build out their own 10x10 or 20x40 and tell their Porsche story, let their products be touched and felt. I think the trade side of classic and modern Porsche in a central location is really missing. We've been talking to Alexander Weaver and Ian Keller, who have been partners of ours for a long time in the auction world. They were our first partner at their former job and auction house. And now being with Broad Arrow, we've been always rapping on how do we do an auction at Luft? Because it's just so ripe. There's so many great cars at the event, and people love the experience of a live auction. But I didn't want to dilute and I didn't want to disrupt the essence of Luft. So all these ideas that we've been baking on for 5, 6, 7 years, they're coming to air water, and it's not going to be for everybody, but I do think it will be for a big demographic of people who want to go to a car experience and have almost a Porsche theme park of different things to see and do. We will focus on race cars. We will highlight great photo moments. We will have the very most curated, unseen rare cars, but we'll also have the small guys that come from another state and built their car in their garage, whether that's a 914 or a 944. Doesn't really matter to me. It's about the stories and the community and a party. It has to be a good time. And I think that having 50 cars go across the block. And these are not just collector car, $1 million cars that are old race cars. We're going to have some great sort of enthusiast build cars. Marco from TLG, he's going to auction off his dad's Longhood that's close to you and I in our hearts, because we have cars very similar to the veins of what Tony built probably 30, 40 years ago with his own best parts list. So I love bringing together the community. Quickly, Air Water has become a multi-day event. Overcrest on Friday is a big part of this. Sunday, the All Porsche and VW swap meet has jumped over from their traditional Sunday after Lit Show in March. They had some weather disruptions this year, and so they've done this on their own, and we're supporting it because we love the guys at MP, where they'll be holding the Porsche swap meet. I always call Rod Emery for my swap meet advice. I'm like, dude, where do I sell an SC engine that's in the way, in the back of my storage? And so, yeah, I love the aspect of them doing a swap meet on Sunday. It's not at our venue, it's not our gig, but we're going to support the community coming out and all the different pop-up
events.
That's
really important, man. Like, it's a lot of people that do events or they do stuff, they try to manage everything that's happening. And I know you've got your plate full, and I know you're managing a lot, of course, but like, when someone wants to do something like, hey, I'd really like to have a swap meet, you don't try to absorb that necessarily, you just encourage the community to do it. And I think that's really important to have that separation, where it's still community driven, but you still have a thing that's a catalyst for it to happen.
Yeah. And I think separating church and state there is collaborating. When you gave me a call and said, hey, I want to collaborate on an idea, and I'm going to do a lot of the heavy lifting, but here's what we want to do, and here's the efficiencies, and here's the no-brainers. That's what makes a good association, a good collaboration. That's your expertise. We're not going to get into the road rally business. On Sunday, we don't want to be swappers, but it's about having that dialogue and a like-minded perspective on how to do this with a blend of enthusiast culture, but also that it's professional enough for us to throw it up on our socials and point some fingers over and say, hey, this is something you want to check out. Because a lot of people show up to Luft or to Air Water, and they're from out of the country or out of the state, and they want to be able to decide where they're going to go and what they're going to do. And so we like to just shed light on people who are doing great things at a professional level, but also with the enthusiasts in mind.
What have you learned putting on an event like this? What goes into putting on an event like this? I've done a couple car shows, and I still can't really wrap my mind around what you guys must be going through as things lead up to the event.
Yeah, it's sort of like throwing your kid a birthday party and inviting 10,000 people. There are a lot of things you have to think about. It is not as simple as what color is the restaurant going to be and what's going to be on the menu.
Running a business, though. I mean, that would be pretty dope for the kid.
But yeah. That's like, you got to look this up. A friend of mine told me about Ruby's Quinceanera. I'm going to butcher the Spanish pronunciation, but there was this little girl named Ruby who had a birthday party in Mexico City, and her dad was a farmer, and he invited everybody to Ruby's birthday, and then all of a sudden 20,000 people showed up, and I think shit went down. But it's a great problem to have. We love the enthusiasm and the support that people want to come out and see what Mr. Zwart has creative directed and laid out for awesome photo moments and an art show with cars and architectural backdrop. That's what we do. That's what Air Water does. That's the essence of Luftgekult. But giving people other things to do other than just look at static cars is really the experience. And that's the heavy lift. And when you add scale to it, and you add legal, and you add fire code, and you add all these different things that a show of this magnitude really requires, there's a reason why there aren't many that do it, because it is a lot of work. And when I started Luft with Howie Idelson in 2014, it was 40 cars and 200 people at a coffee shop. And that in itself was a lot of stress because we were rookies. But to do something like that is pure fun. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's just a different scale. And we want to be all inclusive. We don't want to sell out in the first hour, contrary to the internet's belief. We want to bring people together and celebrate these cars and find a common bond. I've always said about our events, 51% of the people we're talking to don't own a Porsche. We want people to come out and to experience what this brand is about and why all of us car people are just totally infected by driving vintage and classic Porsches, but to tell it through art and to tell it through a lens that's for the non-car goer as well. It should be a great day out. I'm excited about Airwater because my plan is to leave Airwater in its place. I hope that this venue will really surprise a lot of people and be a no-brainer in everybody's mind when they're driving out at the end of the day on Saturday the 27th. And I've told the venue, and I'll say this, Jeff always tells me I say too much in a public forum, but you got to live your truth. I hope that we're here at this venue on this weekend for years to come. I hope that this becomes one of the largest static Porsche gatherings in the world, and that we bring more ideas and more cars and more people. We have the infrastructure, and I believe we have the experience and the knowledge to continue to welcome in new people and to give them a great day out. And the last thing I'll say is, whether you come for an hour or you come for six, it should be like visiting a museum. Take it in as much as you want. Spend as much time with each individual car and maybe their owner. Or just come drop by. Try to keep the ticket price down so that people can just come and get a feel for what this is all about and check out the Action Sports Arena with all of the overland cars and off-road 911s and tents on roofs. Or cruise over and see a live auction for the first time, or grab some food and bev without having to stand in a really long line, knock on wood. Those are the kind of the key user experiences that we want to have. We want to have load in and load out tight. We want people to have a mellow good time. And yeah, hopefully the 3 or 4 days of calendared events now that have kind of happened overnight will make that worth the trip for people from out of state or from more than a few hours away.
Yeah, it's great that it's such a welcoming aspect to spectators. And like, if you don't have a Porsche, you don't own a Porsche, but you just want to come hang out and see some cool shit, you know, it's a good place to spend your Saturday.
Yeah, and we've tried to really find efficiencies in that. We've collaborated with Brahmo, a new app where you can shoot a small QR code, which is the entrance sticker for the entered cars and enthusiast cars that are coming into the show. Hit that with a QR code, and you should have a simple and easy to navigate year, model, color, and a little bit of storyline behind the owner and the car. And for That's those cool. car owners to be able to cross-pollinate and be like, dude, I saw your Lido Gold 65911. Like, I've never seen that color before. What the heck was that? That can happen before the event, during the event, or after the event. We've decided to try to make a one-of-one trophy. We've never done trophies at Luft, but Airwater will hand out to an enthusiast a custom-painted Conifer, a Rye racing helmet. It's done up in the Airwater colors with Mobile One, and we want people to interact with these cars and to vote for their best car.
Head, man, is it gonna fit?
It will fit, but it's meant to be something that's bragging rights. You were the car that the most people tagged as their favorite car on Brahmo, and you're gonna walk away with a guy who painted Daniel Ricciardo's Formula One helmets for quite a few years. It's no joke. And Conifer, check him out on Instagram. He's a legit artist.
He's incredibly talented.
Yeah, so it should be fun.
My favorite thing is that Scirocco he did for Jason Whipple.
Yeah.
That thing is dope. So we talked a little bit about maybe 10, 15 more minutes. I don't know how busy you are, but
I'm good.
Okay. So I think it's really interesting to get a race car driver's perspective on what's cool. You know, we, as regular people, again, we kind of look for different things as like icons of cool, right? So like the race car driver in general as an archetype is pretty cool. And, I was talking to my friend, Michael Gideon, and he showed me this article that Road and Track did in like 1971, 1972. And Donahue had gone out, Mark Donahue had gone out and driven like, 911 T, E, and S, and the E was a Targa. And the article is all about the race car driver's perspective on, and I think this is kind of like before Donahue was really into Porsche, like early 70s, like 71. Like, I don't know, he was doing a ton of Porsche stuff. Anyway, so he comes in, maybe that's how he got the job. I don't know. So he comes in, he drives all these different cars, and he's like, and it was interesting to read this because he goes, yep, the S is not good. It has no torque. It's too peaky. It's a bad street car, blah, blah, blah. Like, he like didn't really like the S. He really liked the the Targa was his favorite car. So he chose the 911E Targa. Is like, that's the one I like. I love the way the dynamics feel. Feels good. It's not so peaky. He's like, you don't need the horsepower anyway. This is an Autobahn country. They should just shorten the gears up on these cars. And he had all these different opinions and stuff like that. But then he chose the Targa. And he's like, well, the Targa is the coolest one for me. So I was thinking, like, what is your kind of cool, and it doesn't even have to be a Porsche. We'll open it up to anything. Like, what is Patrick Long's car today that he thinks is cool? What is his kind of like, what is his Mark Donohue's Targa?
You know, the car that's freshest on my mind, I really think it's down to what, how you're using it and what your driving style is. I want a car that I can roll the center of a third or fourth gear corner and not wonder, is the tire going to start to give up? Not wonder, do I have to trail brake it to get enough weight on the front so it turns in? It's a car that has connection between its sort of low speed ride height and rake, and then its differential. I don't really think it's about how much horsepower or how big the brakes are. I think it's the in-between of accelerating and braking that's the most engaging for me. And that's really about controlling roll. It's about how the diff locks when you're on power and how it is in coast. And so I like to get real nerdy and technical on setup. And ultimately, a word that, well, I use the word ultimately way too many times. How about the word Jörg Burgmeister uses, which is connection. The front and rear connection of the car, and when they roll, how they roll, at what rate they roll, and just how in the groove that car is the most fun for me. You can have cars that are way too stiff or way too soft. Answering that question, I drove my 72 yesterday, and it's not perfect, but it's as close as I could get it to perfect. And that comes down to the ergonomics of feeling like you're in your cell and you have all of your tools within reach and within comfort, so that you trust that if something steps out, that you really have the range of motion to bring it back in. And then how does it sound? How does it feel? What's the balance of the engine? And where does all of that tick your box of what you're looking for? Some people need to hear a V8 with straight pipes, and other people need to hear a flat six on MFI. And of course, I pick a 911. But you know, my 911, like yours, similarly, I run a little bit more tire out back. I still run a 185 vintage CN36 from Pirelli up front. I run non-adjustable torsion bar damping. And, you know, the Sachs Green was my shock that I was working with. I'm now working on a Bilstein, but we hand valve that. Craig Watkins at Smart Racing Products is a guy that's a bit of a genius. So I love to work on damping and diff, as I first mentioned. And you can make everything better if you have those two really clicking in with your bars and your springs, or however you're making your real rate of anti-roll and anti-dive.
If you choose the last 60 years, though, that's almost cheating, because you could pick anything. Like, you can go all the way back to 72 and you can go, oh, yeah, that's the car for me. But what if you had to pick a new car? What if you had to pick a car that's made in the last, like, 3 years? I feel like it gets a lot harder, because everything now is, almost everything is high performance, right? Almost everything can do anything.
Yeah.
Is there anything new that excites you? Is Porsche doing anything that excites you? Is Mercedes, BMW? I mean, Hyundai's doing some cool stuff.
Yeah, I want a car that I can go to dinner with my wife, or go out and rip and lean on it if someone's up my butt and need to kind of flex a little bit and get some space because they're a little too excited on a Sunday morning. The car that makes me most excited that I've driven recently, it's definitely the ST. The ST has a lot of hype behind it, but it's understated. I like that it doesn't have huge wings and big graphics. It's got a classic interior. It's H pattern. I talked about this, that driving an H pattern modern car is almost surreal these days. It is this part of you where you get in and you're still having fun. You're still challenged by it. And that's what we all loved about the first time we drove manual, or at least that's what I think everybody loved about the first time driving manual, is it was tough. You had to think about how to shift and when to shift and where to shift.
What was a badge of honor if you could do it and your buddies couldn't? That was pretty dope, right?
Yeah. I remember the first time I had just gotten my license, and my dad had an old Ford Ranger pickup truck. It was a V6 long bed, and it was at 86. This is probably 96. So he had been out of it for quite some time, but one of the guys that worked with him had it, and the deal was he was going to give it to me when I turned 16. So the car is out front of my house. I get home from high school, and I jump in that thing, and I'm like, I got this. You know, I've driven tractors. I've driven pickup trucks on old dirt roads, and all of a sudden, I'm out just driving the open road, and I realized that I had a lot to brush up on how to really drive a manual in city streets, let alone to carry it up onto the canyons. But no, the ST, the gearing, the noises, the, again, back to connection and how well the car put down the power, how connected the front end was, in coast. Andy and the team in Vysok really nailed that car. I love that car. Would I daily drive it? Probably not. I love the new technology in the 911s for a daily, because you could still have a manual and you can still have the over rev of a naturally aspirated feeling engine, but you have that torque on the bottom end of turbo. It's kind of the best of both worlds of, if you think about a 997 in naturally aspirated and in turbo, if you combine those two cars, that's kind of what the modern engine is like to drive, because you have the bottom end of being able to lug it on the turbo, but then you can still rev the piss out of it on top. And so as much as everybody kind of cringed when everybody or everything went to turbo, they still have the DNA and that user experience of a naturally aspirated engine. But now it has that bottom end sort of leave it in one gear and drive to the office. So That's a street
car.
You want
to compromise, though, right? Like, you want to have something that's wrong. I feel like if you need something to be wrong with something, so it has like that, you know, that failure point that you have to overcome, or some sort of, there's got to be like a, like, oh, this is it. Oh, it's really bad at this, but it's really good at this, so it makes it worth it. It almost is like when things get so good at everything, there's no fault and there's no error. So it just doesn't have as much character as it would have if it had something wrong with it.
Yeah, and that's where I'll default back to like a 993, a C2 993 with proper setup and no real unreversible mods. Let's get some English in here this morning.
It's early.
Is that correct? It is early. I love a 993 as a blend of vintage and modern, because I have AC, I have six gears, I have back seats for my kids, I have a comfortable ride, but I can still get it on the cam and hear it sing, and I can still enjoy some of both worlds. So that's kind of my pickup truck 911, if you will, the one that does it all. But if you ask me what is it missing in my life, I need a bed, a truck bed. I need a really roomy back seat so my kids can strap in and bring half their life on a road trip, because they can't go anywhere, even an hour and a half away, without 14 bags of crap. So space. I mean, we all need space. And then it gets down to, if you have a big enough car, a family car, what is a car that you're going to enjoy driving, but also be able to have the utility of a family wagon? And so I love that debate and everything that comes along with it. But I won't bore you with my take.
Yeah, I think that's where you would just end up with a AMG wagon if they would stop screwing those things up. I think that's always the ultimate family truckster, is the, like, an E63 AMG was always, I mean, that was it, right? Who doesn't want to go 180 miles an hour on the Autobahn in a station wagon?
Yeah. I loved the E55. Yeah. That car was so good. You know, I loved the displacement being smaller and having a bit of boost. So what was that? Supercharged 5.5? That thing was really sure.
Forced induction something, yeah.
Yeah, some kind of help on the bottom end instead of the big throaty NA car. But yeah, it needs a trailer hitch. If I'm driving a wagon, it needs a trailer hitch for BMX bikes and dirt bikes.
Yeah, absolutely. Pat, thanks for hanging out, man. I will see you in a couple of weeks. I encourage everybody to, the link will be in the description for getting some tickets to Airwater. It's open to spectators. We hope everybody comes out and sees what you guys have built over there. I think you're onto something really good with the way you guys are putting things together. You should be really proud of what you've done.
Thank you. Yeah, we're going to keep tickets open as long as we can for spectators. We've got plenty of parking. Costa Mesa, California, right by SNA Airport. Cars are sold out long ago, enthusiast cars and our hero cars of different kinds of collectors and such, that we're helping bring into town. It's going to be a fun party, and I appreciate you guys doing the rally on Friday. That's going to be fun having you guys roll in Friday night as a group, get you parked up, and hopefully we'll have a cold beverage for you.
I appreciate that. Thanks for hanging out, man. I can't thank you enough.
Thanks, Chris.